From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. In the midst of the uproar over the firing of FBI Chief James Comey by President Trump earlier this week, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited Washington and sat down with both Secretary of State Tillerson and President Trump. For more on that, we spoke with Dmitry Babich, a journalist and senior editor at the Russian news agency Sputnik, via Skype from Moscow Thursday. Dmitry, it's a pleasure to have you back, and it's been quite a busy week so far.
Well, you are right. I think it's a good development that the Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov managed to come to Washington after, I think, about 3 years of a pause in our relationship. And I think that basically this visit was a success, a mild success, you know, a modest success. But what was good was that both sides refrained from hostile rhetoric. Russia didn't say, why are you supporting terrorists in Syria? The United States didn't say, stop supporting terrorists in Donbass, or, you know, the separatists in Donbass. I think both sides more or less understand what to expect from each other, and they act accordingly, at least on the diplomatic level right now.
You know, there's been sort of a variation between what they've been calling here for a few years now, the optics of things. In other words, the apparent. Some things that seem to be going on in the real world in the background. You had the missile strike in Syria, for example. It was last month, I guess, early April. And people saying, Trump is turning on his campaign pledge and is taking an aggressive posture. Now we're seeing, however, arming the Kurds, despite what Turkey says, and sort of navigating towards a position where it seems like there's going to be some policy convergence between the U.S. position and the Russian position and the Syrian position, Iranian position, about what to do on the ground in Syria. And I think that's a positive development. Do you see that, too?
Well, you are right. I think we still will see a lot of tragedies in Syria. Obviously, not only the United States, but primarily the European Union is not prepared to abandon its destructive policy of regime change, you know, removing Mr. Assad at all costs. But look what happened. For the first time since the start of the civil war in Syria, we have Russia, Turkey, and the United States supporting the same idea, these so-called de-escalation zones in Syria. So if someone told me that that would be the case, if someone told me that we would agree on this 2 years ago, I wouldn't believe it. So with all the critique that one might have against Mr. Erdogan, who broke a lot of his own promises, who is very unreliable as a foreign policy partner, whose democratic credentials are bad, even though, of course, better than the European Union suggests, and the European Union should look at itself better in this situation. It is in no position to lecture Mr. Erdogan. But Russia, Turkey, the United States, and last but not least, Iran, have agreed on a project which is supposed to protect the civil population from military strikes. That's a good development.
Yeah, I mean, when we were looking a few months back at, fighting in Syria being a potential spark for World War III, this is certainly a change in the direction of everything, yeah. And then look at Libya. It seems that Russia's engagement there is deeper. The U.S. hasn't really moved to block that at all. It seems to be encouraging it, and it may be a very constructive force for developments in Libya.
Well, I think that in general what happened in Libya is a tragedy, and I think it's a shame that the Western press is not paying it almost any attention. I mean, as Antoine de Saint-Exupéry used to say, if you tamed someone, you took upon yourself the responsibility for that person, for that animal. If you domesticated an animal, then you should take care of it. The Western countries have plunged Libya into a conflict, you know. They wanted to remove the government of Mr. Gaddafi, you know, controversial as it was, to put it mildly. They wanted to remove it at all costs. They did it. And then it turned out that it was a much better tuned, much more finely tuned society than the Westerners expected with all their arrogance, you know. It turned out that the country, instead of becoming democratic and market-oriented, blah, 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 the country just plunged into a new civil war with the so-called Islamic State gaining ground there. Russia is trying to work with different agents in Libya. Russia is having a dialogue with General Haftar, with the government in Tripoli, you know, trying to use all the channels in order to help the Libyans reconcile themselves with each other. The West is somehow simply not interested. I mean, when was the last time that you heard the West engaging in Libya? Until recently, the only messages were like, we're talking to the government there in order to stop the illegal migration. We're asking the government to destroy all the vessels that the people smugglers can use. Well, I mean, if you translate it into human language, that means, you know, there are desperate people who want to leave Africa at all costs, from Libya and from other countries. And the rich governments in Europe are paying a sort of a government in Libya in order to destroy the vessels by which these desperate people may try to reach Europe. So that's what it means in reality, just like when Mr. Trump says that he keeps all the options on the table with North Korea, the translation is he is threatening war. You know, he is threatening that he might wage a war on North Korea. I'm sorry, bad as the North Korean regime is, threatening war is prohibited by the United Nations Charter. And everyone understands what having all the options on the table means.
Right. I mean, the missing option is war, because that's the one that's illegal. And when you suddenly declare all of them are on the table, what you're doing is adding the missing one, which is war. Korea is a good place to look at because of the election that just took place there. As belligerent as the U.S. policy has been since the 1950s, really, towards Korea, the people, the voters in the Republic of Korea or South Korea, are much less hostile towards the North, towards the DPRK. They elected someone who said he wants to speak with them and that he wanted the THAAD missile system that the U.S. has been installing since Obama's administration. They want that out.
Well, you know, judging by my talks with South Korean diplomats here in Moscow, they were speaking in much friendlier terms about Russia than about the United States. And that was the case even under the conservative administrations that basically, you know, the South Korean regime had during the last 10 years. You remember that the daughter of the former military dictator, she has been the president until recently. 2 days ago, the new president, Moon Jae-in, was elected. He is a very different person, by his credential at least, than the previous president, Park Geun-hye. He basically follows the sunshine policy of Kim Tae-jun, one of the first democratic South Korean presidents, who, let me remind you, had bilateral meetings with Kim Jong-il when Kim Jong-il was still alive. And he proved by his example, Kim Tae-jun, the South Korean president, former South Korean president, he proved that it was possible to talk to North Korea, and that it was even possible to have joint economic projects. Everyone expected the situation to develop in the Chinese direction with the regime in North Korea you know, adopting elements of market economy and becoming more like what China is today. Why it didn't work? Well, I think part of the responsibility is with the West, because the sinister military exercises right next to the North Korean borders continued every year and even more often. You know, a lot of international press helped the conservative administrations to get elected in South Korea, so they controlled South Korean policy for the last 10 years. And when people say that, you know, that meeting between Kim Dae-jung and Kim Jong-il, that it was paid for, that the South Koreans just bribed Kim Jong-il into meeting the South Korean president, well, I'm sorry, but it's better to have bribes and
right,
to have
the
some
bombs.
Sort of
right.
shady relationship than to threaten each other with nuclear weapons.
Right,
and,
okay.
and plunging the whole region into a war which it simply cannot afford.
Right. It's like, what do? Do we shoot each other or do we go out and have a few cocktails? You know what I mean? Which is a better choice? Yes, the cocktails are
even
bad for your liver.
The origins of the cocktails, I mean, the financial origins, are right. not immediately clear.
Right.
It is certainly better, and it makes much less sense to investigate the origins of cocktails than the origins of possible nuclear explosions.
Right.
right.
Yes, absolutely true. So, you know, and I mean, from the perspective of Pyongyang, forgetting the fact that the U.S. leveled the north part of the country, 60 years ago, which people there don't forget, by the way. It's not an easy thing to do when you're the recipient of that kind of bombardment. But forgetting that, since 1991, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, both Pyongyang and Havana saw the U.S. attempt to roll the ball forward, and they were trying to blow those regimes over. Both countries suffered an increase in sanctions and the tightening of the, you know, freezing out from the global economy, hostile military activity, and so rather than being allowed to try to make friends with the South and follow the German model and then end up where China is, we end up here, where only a few weeks ago there were threats back and forth of nuclear war off the table. You know, no nuclear war was off the table.
Well, I think history may simply mislead us in this situation. I think what, you know, the real change and the negative change in the last 30 years, or maybe 20, 25 years, happened with the West.
Right.
And not with the regimes which are associated with 20th century totalitarianisms.
Right.
The problem is that the West became totalitarian.
That's right. That's right. We've discussed this before.
My impression, for example, when I visited Vietnam, In the early 2000s, you know, of course, I mostly spoke English to the Vietnamese, didn't understand French. They, of course, did not understand Russian. So in order, the language of immediate communication was English. And they might take me for an American or for a British person. And they were all immensely friendly.
Right.
I felt a sudden change, I think in 10 or 11 years later, I felt a change. Why? Because the attitudes, you know, the conduct of the United States changed. It's very hard for me to imagine someone even like Jimmy Carter or someone like, you know, JFK. It's very hard for me to imagine them threatening, you know, North Korea with nuclear weapons.
It's
seriously pondering the possibility of a limited nuclear conflict in Southeast Asia. Placing the anti-missile systems, you know, these thoughts right next to China, despite China's protests. I think what happened was that we somehow missed it simply because it was not announced on the Western radio and not even on Russian radio. The West changed. And now, you're right, I think Vietnamese and the North Koreans, they were ready to forget the wars that they led with Americans in the 1950s or 1960s. They were ready to let bygones be bygones if suddenly the United States did not get much worse than it used to be. So it's a threat again now. And in this situation, when a certain country is a threat again, immediately you have a change in attitude. You know, in Russia, I can assure you that since the 1970s, you know, since I was a kid, probably even earlier, there was no hostility from Russians towards Germany, not just Eastern Germany, but even Western Germany. It was supposed that we would allow bygones be bygones because there were real pacifist cabinets in West Germany. There were social democrats who were not bombing social democrats, you know, like so-called social democrats, Solana or Schroeder, bombed Yugoslavia, right?
Right.
So they were a very different breed of social democrats, the ones who once had to flee Hitler, like Willy Brandt.
Right.
And the attitude to Germans was excellent in Russia, I can assure you. Now, because there are German tanks in Poland, rolling through Poland, like in 1941, there are German troops in the Baltics, there are German sanctions, suddenly I see how the attitude in the grassroots of Russian society is changing. Not because we changed so much, but because Germany changed in the last 10 or 20 years.
Yeah, so, you know, following that logic, looking at what's happened on the ground in South Korea, for example, where when the sabers, a nuclear saber is being rattled, it's going to go off in their lap. And the people in Japan, the same thing. And while I mean, you've got the history of just, you know, the Second World War in Asia, Japan having invaded and killed millions of people, tens of millions of people in China and enslaved people in Korea. Now, while the U.S. is rattling the saber, Japan is moving towards further repeal, in fact, of Article 9 in the Constitution. The people in Japan are looking at missiles fired from North Korea that clearly are intended to signal we can hit Okinawa and Tokyo and et cetera, saying, okay, well, the U.S. wants a war with North Korea. It's going to be fought in our lap as well, and it produces a response from the people in both places.
Well, I think you're right, there are many negative factors at work here. You know, many negative factors that make a new war possible. And the situation is absurd, but let's face it. You know, the former communist regimes, or countries which used to have communist regimes, they have become a lot better, a lot more humane, not only in Europe, but also in other countries. And the former liberal democratic regimes, you know, the free regimes have become much worse and sort of lumped into one. In this situation, a lot of people are confused. I mean, you have even a generational gap, I think. I can see in Russia how people of the older generation, the intellectuals of Gorbachev's generations and younger, they're much more pro-Western, and sometimes they just don't want to notice certain realities about the West, certain realities which younger people like me do notice. Yes. And with North Korea, you know, even if you look at the buildings in Pyongyang, you see that there was also some economic development, you know. Of course, people have now more access to information than before. It's simply impossible in the modern world to lock people up information-wise, as it was the case in the 19th or in the 20th century. And what do we have in response from the West? We have Japan, which is absolutely unrepentant now about 30 years. Let me remind you that Korea, all of Korea, had been occupied by Japan for 30 years, starting from the early 20th century. So they suffered a much greater humiliation and in some places greater pain than the Chinese, because they are close. If you look at the map, you know, Korea was the closest to Japan, so it was always the first victim of Japanese expansionism, whenever that expansionism occurred. And now it is clear that the United States and Japan have total military superiority there. And they want to even expand that superiority. And they accuse China of being expansionist. Look what the United States is doing in other parts of the globe. I mean, China is building new islands in the ocean.
Right.
The United States says that it has interests in Iraq, you know, which is a completely different culture.
Right, of course.
That it has interests in Ukraine, which had been a part of the Russian Empire for 300 years.
Right.
That it has interests in all of Africa, you know. It has interests just about everywhere.
Including in those Chinese islands, by the way. The China can't build them there because we have interests there.
Have built, you know, it already has interests there. So what people are getting?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's the game that's played, though. All right. So we're moving forward. We've had these meetings both yesterday with Tillerson and with Trump. The press conference that the foreign minister gave at the Russian embassy in Washington yesterday was an interesting thing to watch. You know, we still have this Russiagate narrative going on here in the U.S., and it got goosed again with the firing of Comey on Tuesday to where it's at the center. Oh, see, there really is there. That's kind of what's going on. They were poking at Foreign Minister Lavrov yesterday, trying to go into that. He was saying, in essence, to them, and I think almost word for word, saying, you know, aren't we grown-ups here? This is, you know, childish games. Mm-hmm. There was real policy, I'm sure, discussed once they got into the room, Tillerson and Trump, and there's going to be some real implications. We've got, as we've been discussing, in various parts of the world, people on the ground looking for a change in U.S. foreign policy, whether the people in South Korea, the people in the Philippines, the people in Japan, elsewhere. What kind of, everything's been on one track with some very strong motion for a good long while. What kind of adjustments do you think, with Trump being under attack on, you know, relationship with Russia, can be made that can make a positive, positive relationship, if not come into being now, develop?
Well, I mean, I'm afraid that the hope that a lot of people in Russia, for example, had, and maybe even in Europe, a lot of these hopes associated with Trump were deceived, not because Trump cracked up to be worse than we expected. It turned out that the European leaders, you know, the EU leaders and the American establishment, I mean, they're not free people, they're subjugated, but they're not subjugated by one person.
Right.
They're subjugated by an ideology. Mm. So, when foreign policy specialist in Russia said, Europe is totally subservient to America, probably they thought that it would work like in the 20th century, with normal people. Okay, people in the United States elect someone more peaceful. He is the president. He can give a command and everyone will listen to him.
Right.
It turned out to be that the situation is much worse.
Right.
The Europeans are subservient, but they are not subservient to the elected president of the United States.
Right.
They're subservient to an ideology which is hell-bent on forcing the world accept their narrative on everything, forcing the world to become totally loyal. And in order to achieve that loyalty, they are prepared not only to lie and to use the media at their disposal, they are also prepared to wage wars. In Syria, like they did in Iraq, like they do in Ukraine, because supporting the regime in Ukraine is tantamount to waging war,
right,
with the people of Donbass. So basically what happened when Trump was elected was that, the reaction from the EU was personally against him, but total loyalty to the militarist ideology. You know,
right.
Trump said during his electoral campaign, wouldn't it be nice if we had good relations with Russia?
Right.
And the response from the European Union was, he wants to have good relations with Russia. How awful.
Right.
How dangerous.
Right.
He's a threat to the European security. I'm not underestimating here. That was the statement from the head of the European Council, Donald Tusk.
Yep.
The president of the United States is a threat to European security.
Yep.
Why? Because he doesn't say bad things about Russia.
Yep.
In fact, he says, but he doesn't say them every 5 minutes like I do.
Right.
That already makes him a threat to Europe.
That's right.
in this situation, of course, it is difficult to expect from Trump and simply from the election that brought him to power. It's difficult to expect, immediate positive effect on international relations. I think that. I'm sorry, the regime in the United States has to change, not the person who formally heads the regime. It's like a lot of expectations were deceived when, Khrushchev replaced Stalin and Brezhnev replaced Khrushchev.
Right.
But the rhetoric and sometimes certain actions basically stayed the same, simply because if Brezhnev tried to act in a completely different way from Stalin, he would have been removed. We have the same situation in the United States. I mean, the United States is not subjugated by one clan or by one person. It's subjugated by a terrible ideology, the ultra-liberalism, which views the current Western model of what they call identity politics, the current Western model of what they call market economy. They view it as the best option for mankind, which has to prevail by all means. And they sometimes refuse to notice that the so-called market economy in the interpretation of the people like Lawrence Summers or the people who are now running the U.S. economy, in their interpretation, that is actually a monopoly. It's a monopoly of big companies producing various things that other countries simply won't be given a chance to produce. And it is capitalism, but it is not market economy. Sometimes capitalism is against market economy because capitalism, unrestrained, has a tendency towards monopolization, just like totalitarian communism, just by different means. They achieve the same end.
Right. Yep. The consolidation of power and wealth. That's the end game when consolidating power and wealth are the purpose of the economy.
and we can, it's interesting. It's interesting looking at the media, we can see how monopoly kills satisfaction, diversity.
Perfect example. Yep.
If you look at the news on Western television, you can speak 5 different languages, but you'll hear the same narrative in English, in French, in German, like I do, in Polish.
Right.
You see the same pictures because there's just one company, APTN, sending pictures from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they are concentrating on themes that interests their bosses. So we have a situation when, for example, the plight of mysterious, I think non-existent gay man in Chechnya, their plight is given hundreds of times more attention than the real problem of millions of Orthodox Christian believers in Ukraine, whose church is forced to change its name because it used to have the words Moscow Patriarchate in it, who are forced under threat of arrest. The priests there are forced to approve the civil war, the so-called anti-terrorist operation in the East. And this is the real limitation of freedom of cult, of freedom of religion. But that is not noticed. What they notice is, rumors, anonymous interviews published in a Russian newspaper about gay men in Chechnya having problems with the local regime.
All right, Dmitry, thank you very much. A pleasure as always.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye-bye, my friend.
Bye-bye. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.